I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm honored to welcome Ruth Messenger. Ruth is the president of American Jewish World Service, the world's leading Jewish organization working to end poverty and realize human rights in the developing world. Ruth came to AJWS in 1998 after a 20-year career in public service in New York City. As a leading activist for human rights around the globe, Ruth speaks widely and holds leadership roles in the faith-based advocacy arena. Ruth currently sits on the State Department's Religion and Foreign Policy Working Group and co-chairs the Sub-Working Group on Social Justice. Ruth, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you on.
Thank you, David. I'm delighted.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about why you do what you do, and if we could start there.
Sure. I do social justice work, and that's the way in which I describe it because that's what I've always done. I cared about making things better for others. I was raised in a family whose general mantra was the city and the state and the country have been good to us, and it's time to make sure that we pay back and meet the needs of those who are less fortunate. I was given an orientation to do that work by not just by charity, but by making change in people's circumstances, allowing people to fulfill their own visions of justice, advocating for political and policy change, and that is something that grew on me slowly. And I do the particular work that I do now because there was a moment in my life where I had done justice work in this country, and particularly in an urban setting in New York, and the opportunity was available to switch to do the global work and to learn more in the process.
So would you say that having a set of core values is really intrinsic to what you've done throughout your life, and promoting or fostering change in others is part of your work?
Absolutely. That certainly what I've done for a very long life is based on an intrinsic set of values, which I try to live up to as much of the time as possible. It is very oriented toward change, but I'm a little, I wouldn't use the word fostering change in others, because I think that the people that I've worked with, both domestically and internationally, are people who want to change their circumstances, get the government to do more, organize to affect various changes in their lives. And what I have tried often in different jobs, but certainly in this one, to be in a position to do is to help them with the resources they need and help them with the connections that I have to realize their changes, the changes that they want to see.
Helping people use the resources they have and acquire new resources that they need is a really important role. What was your first position at AJWS? You've now been in the organization for a long time.
Right. So I came into AJWS as its third director. As president/CEO, I mean, that's my current title, but there were two people who ran the organization in its first 12 to 13 years, and then I came in that leadership position. And I've been here for 16 and a half years.
What's it like coming in at the top position?
Well, you know, that's a really great question for the work that you're doing and for the ways in which you're trying to help people think about how to function in the work world and make change. It's not really applicable to my situation because when I came in as the CEO of AJWS, it was a virtually invisible organization. It was very small. It had a budget of less than $3 million. It had a staff that had been put together by the former executive director, but had very few people who were hugely committed to the work over time or were likely to be able to lead the organization. They were, so in other words, the people who were here, including the professionals, were people who were looking for a leader who had some capacity to raise money, do more outreach, make the organization better known. So that's a very different circumstance than is sometimes the case when people are coming in to run an organization that's already highly visible, well-established, and has top-level executive staff who aren't at all sure that they need a new CEO. So my circumstance was much, much, much different and much easier.
Okay, so does that mean that you felt very welcomed when you came in?
I did, except by the person I fired, I felt very welcome. I met with everybody on the staff in my first week to ask them what they did and to tell them that there were aspects of the organization's work that were not familiar to me, and so I would need some substantive and content training, as well as, although I had the process and managerial skills that the organization needed. And there was one person who couldn't tell me what she did, so I actually did fire her. But other than that, people were ecstatic to have a focused director. One of the problems had been that, like many not-for-profits, and I'm sure this will be familiar to your audiences, having existed for almost 13 years, it had sort of run into that moment when the board chair was arguing with the executive director was arguing with the board. People weren't sure that they wanted the organization to continue. The people who most wanted it to continue were not people in positions of power or authority. So there was a little bit of chaos, which also made it an easier moment to come in.
Although that's actually pretty common for organizations when they get past the first phase of existence. Yes, we exist, but why do we exist? Is there really a need for us? What are we going to become? How are we going to do it? How do we get beyond this sort of early stage organization? And I'm also wondering what it was like for you, given the kind of prominent positions you had prior to coming into AJWS, to be facing the kinds of challenges to essentially turn an organization around.
Well, I mean, that was, I had a set of experiences from my professional training, which is in social work, my experience as a community organizer, an administrator, and my 20 years in politics, helping, I'm doing among other things, helping small grassroots organizations, so that I knew I had the skills, the set of skills that could be used to take this organization and, I want to say, rebuild it, because it had lost a little bit, as you say, that's not uncommon, and become a leader who could help it to grow. So I had those experiences. Now, to be honest with you, it's also the case that when I came here, I had just lost an election. I needed a job. This sounded really exciting, partly because I knew I would be learning some different things, but also, quite frankly, given the state of AJWS then, it was like, okay, I might be able to make something really great of this organization, and I might not, but if I don't, it's like nobody's going to be surprised.
Interesting. So looking back over the history of your time at AJWS, it certainly has grown. What are some of the challenges of scaling an organization?
Those are huge.
Because those issues are probably the questions that I get asked the most, and that I see people really struggling with.
So I think there's a lot. I think that those are really great questions, and I think there's a lot to be said for it, and I'm not surprised that it's what you hear a lot about. First of all, it's hard. It's hard from a variety of ways. It's hard to get the resources, so there's a lot of time and energy spent on fundraising. It's hard in terms of staff, because people who may be very good at what they do at a $3 million level don't necessarily have all of the skills that a $10 million organization needs. And so people sometimes find that they can no longer function as smoothly as they were, or that the organization has made a decision to bring in new people to manage and supervise them, which is not always to people's liking. So there are those growth challenges. And then I would say the other big growth challenge is that there's a point, and I don't think that there's a magic number, but there's a point with any organization where you can't simply grow it by having more money, doing more of the same things with a few more people. There's a point at which you have to step back, rethink what you're doing, impose some value lenses, some strategic planning lenses, and become clearer about what you are as an organization in order to be able to maintain and expand on your growth.
And how do you know when it's time to do that?
Beats me. No, I mean, look, I think for me, and I think that's not uncommon, there was a piece of that was trial and error. And I want to be honest, there's a part of me that loves small, scrappy organizations. I spent, as I said, before I went into politics, I spent some years working with small, scrappy organizations, trying to make something out of nothing, lemonade out of lemons, and I loved that. And then in politics, you know, what you're doing is scrapping for a fight all the time, figuring out how to take the next step. I spent a lot of time, as I said, helping smaller community organizations in the borough of Manhattan grow. And I am, and my style in all of those positions has been hugely entrepreneurial. And there was a joke, which wasn't such a joke, which was that AJWS grew because I never said no to any idea. Then there comes a point where you realize that you're getting too extended, your image and your mission aren't clear even to the people who are most directly involved in the organization as staff and as board, and you just have to take that deep breath. So, I mean, I know if you want a comment, a structural comment, it came to me at a point at which I had restructured the organization, so there were three vice presidents reporting to me, each with a very clear area of jurisdiction. And actually, they were each doing good jobs, but they would not really talk with each other and work through problems together. So my meetings with them consisted of each of them talking about how great his or her division was. And I realized that that was not sufficient, and that I needed someone who would do a better job than I was doing of getting them to acknowledge problems, share with each other, figure out new models and areas of collaboration, and mirror those down for the entire staff. So I worked briefly with a consultant, and then I brought in an executive vice president with the intention of working with him on, and the board, on a period of strategic planning. So I picked more or less the right time when we needed that change, although in retrospect, I would have fewer gray hairs if I'd picked it a little earlier.
Well, I suspect that that's actually a pretty common feeling, is when we finally do something, we realize, well, we could have done that sooner.
Yeah. I think you're right. That's a pretty regular situation. It also occasionally comes to the point where you know someone on your staff should no longer be on your staff. The longer you take, the sorrier you'll be that it took you so long.
Ruth, what do you think are some of the hardest tasks we have to accomplish as leaders?
I think one of the hardest tasks for a leader is to actually learn how to listen. People get to be leaders in this society by having something to say and learning how to be heard and to influence others to work with you, and that's critical. But I think to be a really good leader, whether it's at the staff level or with a broader constituency, you have to really learn how to shut your mouth and listen to the people that you want to lead or that you want to work with, and make sure you understand what their vision of the world is and what their goals are. And only after that can you figure out the best ways to work together. Also, if you do that, you end up finding people who are more likely, more able and more likely to be your colleagues in the effort.
Would you be willing to share a story or an example of how listening makes a big difference for somebody who's a leader?
I'll share two. One is from my political life because it's the most dramatic. When I was on the city council in the 80s, there was a proposal. This was during the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And there was a proposal in the city of New York and the state of New York to legalize clean needles. And I was coming at this from, I don't know, probably from a sanctimonious position, but I was like, why on earth would we be doing that? It's just a way of enabling drug use, and drug use is not only spreads HIV/AIDS, but it's damaging. So I said I was opposed to this proposal. And the activists who were promoting this change, fortunately for me, knew enough about my overall politics to think that I just needed to be educated. So they asked me if I was willing to come with them to where they ran an illegal needle exchange, which I did. And I sat under the elevated train in the South Bronx at midnight, where each person that night, each person who showed up with a bundle of dirty needles to exchange them for clean needles, was asked to come over and explain to me why they wanted clean needles. Or the essence of what they said, David, was, I am not able to kick my habit, but I do not want to be in a position in which either I contract a deadly disease or, God save me, I pass it on to someone else. And it was so obvious, and I just felt like, okay, now you've learned that you can't just listen to your colleagues in the legislature or to the other people who are doing global justice work. You have to listen to the people on whose behalf you're doing the work. And in the work at AJWS, that's a consistent lesson. So there are endless examples of when we ask people what it is they want and how they would use our support, we need to listen to them. And we partly need to listen to them because their view of the world is very different than ours, and they are, let's say, desperate to realize their right to own land. But unlike me, they don't want, after they have title to their own land, they don't want to do 17 other things that will fill in the blank, make them richer, grow their community. They have a way and a style of living. It's being threatened. They want help in preventing the threat from overtaking them, but that's what they want. And the international development field is riddled with people who come in and think that they know what people need. And it's when you're in the field, I mean both literally when you're in the work area, but also when you're on the ground in Africa or Asia or Latin America, you realize that white Western organizations have this terrible reputation that what they do is come in and tell people what the people need and then give them what they think they need without consulting them and without respecting them. And I really learn every time I'm in the field that listening is essential to being an effective collaborator and leader.
Those are great examples.
Thank you.
Ruth, what do you think it means to be an entrepreneur or a leader in 2015 versus what it might have been like or was like when you first started your professional life?
That's a trickier one. I think on the one hand, and that's what I'm trying to say, I have paid more and more attention to all that's been written about leadership, leadership styles, what are the qualities of a good leader, instead of just sort of doing it like off the top of my head, as in, you know, I know things that I believe in, I have a good ability to put them forward, I'm sure I can organize others to join me. So I think there's been a step back to pay attention to what people write about, you know, what makes human beings behave the way they do, what are the right techniques for moving people along. Just as an example, David, we have a concept at AJWS which we use particularly with our donors and supporters and activists. The concept is productive discomfort. That is, we're exposing you to a part of the world and to people in the world who lead very different lives, who want different things, and we want you to be working with them. So we want you to really engage with them. We want you to hear what's on their minds. We don't want it to be overwhelming. So we want you to feel a little bit on tilt, as if what you're hearing is not what you thought initially and fundamentally, but not so on tilt that, you know, you feel as if everything you're doing is wasted. So that's a further piece of learning that I think as leadership styles, leadership programs like yours, leadership training has been around, is that there are things for people to learn. I'm not saying they were never there before, but there certainly is a wealth of them now, and it's possible to sort of dip in and do some learning and some reading. So that's one change. I would say another change, which is not quite at that same level, but I'm in a field in which there are more and more people involved, which is good, concerned about the state of global health or slavery and oppression in the world or the lack of food where people are hungry. So the good news is more people are paying attention to those issues. And from our point of view, I would say the bad news is more people are paying attention to those issues who aren't listening, haven't really thought through some of the consequences of what they're doing. The consequence is that we need to be just ever increasingly sharper and clearer about what we do, ever more committed to doing good, high quality grant making and even better high quality monitoring and evaluation so that we can actually report back on our successes.
That's really great. Ruth, who have been some of your influencers in your career?
Lots and lots of people. I've been working for over 5 decades. So there are a lot of people. My mother was an early influencer in both the role of women in the workplace, in the family, and in the world. And she was one of the people in my family who cared about social justice. So that was an early influencer. I have been probably most significantly influenced over the longest period of time by Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. He worked with my mother, so I actually knew him. He marched with Dr. King at Selma in 1963 when I was a young adult who was caught up in all of the social change issues of the 1960s, including the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. And the fact that he spoke out on both of those and spoke in a way that said quite directly, unequivocally, everyone alive today in this country has a responsibility for what's not going well, had a profound influence on me. There's a quote of his that says really what I just said to you, which was on the masthead of my newsletter as an elected official for 20 years. And then, of course, I ended up working in the Jewish community, where it's great to have iconic figures who happen also to have been and written about the connections between Judaism and social justice.
That's
true. I got lots of others.
Would you like to share something about what you're working on now?
Yes, let's do it at two levels. Substantively, we've been a couple of things. We've been privileged with some grants that we've received to do a big piece of work on the issue of forced early child marriage in India, which is just a very interesting issue that brings together family dynamics, roles for women, and clearly, in my mind, has huge potential for changing the lives of girls and women, and in the process, changing their capacity to contribute economically and socially over time. So I think it's an issue with very broad ramifications. Substantively, on a more targeted basis, we're working right now with a pretty ugly issue of statelessness, in which in two different parts of the world right now, governments seem to have no hesitation to push people out of their own country based on issues of religion, race, or presumed nationality. And it seems to me to be one of the most fundamental violations of human rights, and it has a lot of resonance to us as a faith-based organization, since the Jewish community through history has had periods of time when outside forces attempted to render them stateless. So those are the substantive issues that I would name. The structural issues that I would name, David, are we are a 30-year-old organization. I've been here for 16 and a half years, and I'm at a point with the board at which we're trying to do a very serious job of planning for the further stability and sustainability of the organization. And that means both building up reserve funds, creating structures for making executive transitions, ensuring a strong board into the future. So there are a lot of structural issues to move us off whatever plateaus we're on.
So it's interesting how at different stages there are still plateaus.
Oh, for sure. I think all the time. And I think, in fact, one of the things that's you know, in the for-profit community, where you're also doing advice and counseling, there's a pretty quick measure if people's products stop selling or if the competition gets better, then the business knows right away that it's in trouble, it's at a plateau, it's got to figure out something new. In the not-for-profit universe, I think it's fair to say that too often organizations sort of are very comfortable doing what they do, have a bunch of people who support them to do that work, aren't really measuring or reporting back on change, but can go on for a long time, not realizing that they are in fact at a plateau.
Well, you're actually touching on a point that's very close to me, which is trying to understand how successful you are, but more importantly, understanding how you define success to start with. And I find actually that there's a lot of overlap between the not-for-profit, for-profit, and other kinds of organizational worlds, that success is sometimes less quantifiable than people like to think that it is.
Well, I think that's true, and I guess from my learning position, I will just say the opposite. It's also sometimes true that you can, in fact, identify some things to measure what you're accomplishing. And if you don't do that, then people will come along with their own measures. You know, we do work in Washington on policy advocacy, and we've tried to, I think successfully, to say to our staff and our board and some of our donors, we're not going to let ourselves be measured by whether or not the legislation passes, since that's significantly not in our hands. We are going to be measured by how we make the case for changing the legislation, how many meetings we have, how many new co-sponsors we get on a piece of legislation. Those are all measures of progress, and that's what we have to be doing, because we know that achieving those benchmark stages will eventually lead to passage of the legislation.
I agree with you. I think that understanding what it is you can measure and what you should measure is really important. The point that I was going to make is that in the for-profit sector, when I asked questions of my clients about success, the answers are often less about financial success than one might think, particularly with smaller organizations that are non-public.
All right. Well, that makes sense. No, look, there are a lot of other measures of success. Are we doing the good work, the right work? Are the people connected with the organization satisfied? I'm just saying, I like your use of the word plateau. You can get sort of happy. You can get a little too happy about where you are and what you're doing and not pay enough attention to what are the things that come next.
Exactly. So speaking of great work and what's coming next, who do you know personally who is doing really remarkable work?
I'm fond of a lot of different sister organizations. If I was going to mention one person right now, I'd mention a guy named Stephen Lewis, who runs an organization called AIDS Free World, which is concerned about HIV/AIDS, as it sounds, also concerned about the lack of female representation and decision making at the United Nations, on the theory that that constantly biases programmatic work against the needs of women and girls, and most recently has been involved in a huge expose of the impunity of peacekeeping forces engaging in sexual assaults on the citizens of the countries they're assigned to. And I mentioned Stephen, because all of those issues are very powerful and pertinent to the work we do, but I also mention him because he's one of the people, relatively few people I know, who's running organization who is never unwilling, or put it differently, who is always willing to speak out and to say what he thinks and to run the risks that he thinks are necessary to get an issue front and center before other people and to work on it with them.
That's great. Ruth, can you tell our listeners how they can learn more about you and your work?
I can. I just want to mention, since you asked me before about heroes and influences, that I wanted to mention one or two other people. You can decide how you want to use this. But one is Eleanor Roosevelt, who, among other things, had a lot of guts and was the original author of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is a great deal of our work is based on. And another is a group of people who risked their lives to rescue Jews during the Holocaust. And I mentioned that group because so many of the grassroots groups that we work with are in fact literally risking their lives in order to be stand up, stand out voices in their own countries for human rights. Okay, that said, it's easy to find out about us. We have a great website. Our organization is American Jewish World Service, and the website is ajws.org. It's pretty easy to follow. It tells you exactly which countries we're working in. It describes many of the groups with whom we're working. There are several short videos on the website in which you get to see and hear directly some of the people whose lives we've been able to influence for the better and with whom we've worked to make progressive change.
Thank you. And Ruth, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been Ruth Messenger, president of American Jewish World Service. Thank you again, Ruth, for joining us.
Thank you, David.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.